Hey everybody, Joseph Amato here again. Welcome to What's Next, a West Wing podcast. Anthony Caputo is sitting across from me. Anthony, how are you?
Good. How you guys doing?
We just watched episode 5.
Episode 5.
Crackpots and These Women is the title of the episode. This is not one of my favorites in terms of overall story arc, but it does have a lot of stuff going on, a lot of stuff to talk about. You have to know where I want to start. You have to know what the number one thing is for me.
Let's talk about animals, Joe.
Yes, let's talk about animals. For those that don't know me, I care about two things and only two things: New York Mets baseball and animals. Plooey. I love Plooey. I want Plooey to be protected. Ranchers are killers. That's right. They are. And so is the U.S. government. I think the thing that I loved about it the most, that whole section, was that they took... Those animal rights people were so serious that no matter when CJ made a joke, they would not give in. Because that is exactly how I am. When I'm like trying to like defend, like don't eat cows and stop eating cheese and all that stuff, and people make a joke, I'm just like, yeah, that's not funny. Yeah, that is 100% me. So I love that moment. I love that they had it in there. I love that CJ turned. Mm-hmm. Animal rights now. I had to get that off my chest. Number one thing for me. Was there something that stood out to you right away? Or
not for that scene.
Come on.
I don't know why I found that scene so funny. It was just
it is funny.
The dynamic.
Nick
between,
Offerman's in that.
Right.
He's hysterical. It's a funny scene.
It was a funny scene.
And it's funny because those people are right. Wolves are very important to the ecosystem. I think it was Yellowstone. Did you ever see that video where they introduced... It's either Yellowstone or Yosemite. They introduced wolves back into the fold. And immediately the ecosystem... came into balance because wolves were able to maintain. Wolves' numbers have been decimated by ranchers and the like. So, you know, I'm
What were they trying to push for? Like how many
a
wolves miles?
Only highway so that they could go from like Yellowstone to, and that was the other part of it. Like, because they're making such a great like argument. I mean, they're making a sensible argument because wolves are very important. And they do have, they have to cross highways and all this other stuff. And they do get shot and killed by whatever, hunters as well. But then what's great is they're like, yeah, it's going to stretch like however many miles long. It's like the entire coast of like the United States. And it's like $900 million or something. And it's like, all right, I love animals too, but I also understand that we can only do this responsibly. Although I have to say, I hate the argument when CJ's like, how about we build the 9 best schools? That's always like a false argument because we never build the 9 best schools.
It is like a cliche for government to say that.
But they never do it. They never do it. I hate that. I hate when people are like, you know, well, how would you spend those resources? Because that woman for the animal rights thing is right. We're just going to spend it on defense, on something that we
probably
don't need. But yeah. I'm all about the animal thing. Mm. So excited that was brought up. You know, viva la vegan. Let's go.
Let's talk about Baloo the bear.
Yes. So was it Bonnie?
What was his name? Barney the bear?
It was Bonnie. The grizzly bear. I love bears. I love wolves. I love all animals. All right. So that was my favorite thing. But that got to us via the Big Block of Cheese Day. Fun fact, that is a true story. Andrew Jackson actually did have a big block of cheese in a White House for everyone to eat.
I've heard this.
Oh, okay.
I don't know much about it, though.
Yeah. Which is ironic, because Andrew Jackson is, like, a really bad person.
Really?
Terrible.
Huh.
I think he was known as the Indian killer.
Ooh.
That's why people want him off the 20.
Ah.
Yeah, he's not a good dude.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's not a good dude.
Well.
No, I'm just saying.
Hmm.
But so they have the big block of cheese thing, and they have the UFO, and I don't know. I mean, I feel like have you ever seen Scrubs?
A couple of episodes.
Ted from Scrubs. I don't remember the actor's name. He's the guy with the UFO. You were laughing that entire time.
All of these people that came in that were talking, the animal people, the UFO guy.
Hey.
I was cracking
up. The animal
up.
People.
Hey.
Be careful how you the animal people.
I thought it was just hilarious. I don't know why. I just thought it was
funny.
Well,
you know what's good about it? And I don't love necessarily... Like I said, I don't love this episode. Structurally, it's not my favorite. It feels a little loose. But you know what I really did like about it? That you juxtaposed these very funny conversations against something that was... I guess basically the crux of the episode. And something really... I don't want to say dark, but serious, which is Josh getting the card.
Mm.
So you have these funny things that are happening up against... I mean, think about it. Think about, like, people in work. One guy, person A, is having these ridiculous conversations, and person B has this thing, and this very serious thing, they're occupying the same space.
Yeah. I mean, that happens all the time.
It does.
It really does.
I don't know. Thoughts on the card?
I wanted to talk about the card because I feel like...
I think we're going to talk... I mean, yeah, we're definitely...
Really drived a lot of the episode. But I thought that the card... I don't know. It was just... It really seemed to tear Josh up.
Yeah.
And...
From the second he got it.
But, yeah. But the funny thing was, though... Let's flash to the moment when he told CJ about it. Even when he told CJ about it, it didn't seem even important to her. Like, it still seemed to be a very personal thing for Josh.
And it was, because there's something in his past that, I mean, obviously, I mean, it makes, that this isn't one of those things where it's like, I think, open for interpretation. I think it's pretty obvious that it's survivor's guilt. He feels survivor's guilt regarding his sister.
Right.
And he feels twofold that having this card basically means that he's going to survive, other people aren't. So he's already feeling survivor's guilt, even though no one has died. And then he also looked at it, which I thought was interesting, as a white flag of surrender. As if, and now this ties into Toby and the president, as if having this way out means that you don't have to improve or get better because... You have that way out. Kind of what Toby's issue is with the president, which is, yeah, it's really easy for you to just, you know, cash this check on Wednesday when you blast the guy on Tuesday and the thing with the gun bill. But you should want to do better.
Mm.
But yeah, so for Josh, staying on point with Josh, yeah, it's a very personal thing for him. I mean, I don't know if you have... things in your past that rule you like that, because it gets worse for him. It's actually pretty smart. First, it's just his staff that's not with him, and that's hard enough. And then he finds out not only is it not supporting staff, it's not even his peers that come with him.
Right.
So it goes from bad to worse. And then you find out this under thing with his sister.
With his therapist, yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know. Do you have anything like that would just rule you like that? Like the first... I mean, let's not get... This isn't like, you know, therapy with Joe Mata, right?
Yeah.
So I don't want to, you know... But I don't know. For me, it's hard. I don't know that I even could...
I don't know. I'm trying to think. Like, yeah, there's obvious things, right? But I don't want to get too dark and...
Open up
personal.
To me. Yeah, what is it? This is going to be good. This is going to be like the last thing. Eventually you're going to tell me about sand in a jar.
By the end of the episode, you're going to be like, and then my dad beat me.
He didn't love me. And all I ever did was want to please him.
No.
It's always familial stuff, too. It's always father stuff. It's always those things. And Josh just can't get around it. And then it plays into the Ave Maria and how that gets tied in. And
yeah, well, while I'm thinking, what about you? Is there anything that in your past that has altered your behavior in the present, or that has made you change things or make different decisions if it didn't happen?
I think more importantly, are there things that, the way you pointed out, like CJ wouldn't give two thoughts about this card, but it's killing Josh. And I think things that are like that, you never really going to know, because you don't know what's going to affect one person versus another. But I mean, the way I feel about animals is certainly one of those things. Certainly the way I feel about smoking is one of those things, because my dad is a smoker, and how that's really, you know, hurt him and hurt the family, because it's such a, you know, debilitating thing. But yeah, I mean, there are things that, you know, maybe aren't an issue for some people that for me, it kind of, yeah, it does kind of, you know, cut me inside. Certainly guilt. Guilt is the worst. The absolute worst. And you see it all over Josh's face.
Yeah.
And I have to say, Bradley Whitford does a really good job in this episode. I'm not a huge Bradley Whitford fan, but I think he does a really good job. He plays Josh, in case you don't know. I don't know our names.
But I figured you were talking about him.
Yeah, I know. You come up with anything?
No, nothing that I can share. But yeah, they're definitely there.
All right. Well, then there's the Ave Maria, which is one of my favorite songs ever. Would you call that a song? Or would you say it's a piece of music?
It's a song.
Yeah, but no, but okay, so let's put it this way. How familiar are you with Mozart?
I'm familiar.
Okay, so like Lacrimosa.
Right.
Okay. Would you call that a song? You know what I mean?
I guess technically it's called a song, but it's a piece of music.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't know. In any event, Ave Maria is one of my favorite pieces of music.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. And is there like an emotional attachment to that? Or
it's just beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard.
I mean, do you know what the song means? Like the words? I think.
Well,
it was
Ave Maria
German,
is
right?
Ave or, Maria is just mother, right? Like Mary. So it's a song about Mary. But literally, what it means? No. Why do you know?
I think that it. I don't know much about it. But I know that it's a song of protection. I think that.
What do you mean protection?
I mean, it's a Catholic based song, or it's based in religion.
So it should be based in guilt. Hello. Yeah. All right, sorry.
But I think it's called. I think in English, I don't really know, but it's called the hymn of the Virgin's hymn.
I wonder if it loses something in the translation. Schubert was German, right?
I think German. We could find that out, but
okay.
But yeah, I think that has some type of significance, and I think that theme plays through a lot of the things that we're talking about right now too. This whole song is this eerie type of this song in the background as we go through the episode, of, you know, signifying you know, protection, the hymn to the Virgin, and we're talking about all these little these things like. I'm not making much sense right now. But like, so Josh, like, I think that part of his guilt in getting this card and not wanting it is him wanting to protect his staff to the best of his ability and not letting something like that happen again, like when he ran out on his sister.
I think that's a double-edged sword. I really do. I agree with that. I mean, yes, you don't want, but part of, I think, survivor's guilt, I don't have that, but I would assume part of survivor's guilt is that you aren't around to protect. Even if you're not in the position to, I mean, if you remember what Stanley, the psychiatrist, says, he says something like, you ran out of the house. That's what you were supposed to do.
As a child, right?
Right, but think about the card. Like, he's just supposed to...
run out of the house.
Yeah, but like, go to wherever it says. Like, it's not... he's not supposed to give this to everybody else. Like, he's just... and he can't do what he's supposed to do.
And that's interesting, too, that you just said, like, you know, the therapist said you did what you're supposed to do as a child.
Yeah.
Just to run out of the house and go somewhere, right? But he's not a child anymore.
Right,
and maybe he sees
still...
that card. But that's what I'm saying. He sees the card as his ticket to just run out of the house.
It is.
And he's not a child anymore. So he knows that morally this is not the right thing to do.
But even, I would say even more, he still can't even get over what happened as a child.
Right. Yeah,
he still can't. This also brings me to, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but this brings me to, this is one of my least favorite things about Sorkin sometimes. I feel like sometimes he gets a little lazy in the psychiatrist thing. He does the same thing in Sports Night, where he throws in a name by accident.
Oh, like a Freudian slip.
Yeah, I don't think, basically, I don't know if you know this, basically all of Freud's theories have been debunked. Freud is not really considered much of anything these days.
Right.
But that whole thing of me and Sam and Joni and Josh, and it's like, what, you just said Joni.
Right.
And it's like, all right, I get it. It means that he's not, I don't like it. To me, it's lazy. I just wanted to point that out because it bothers me. He, like I said, he did it in Sports Night. Not my favorite thing. I think there are other ways to do certain stuff. And, okay, that's a whole other thing. We'll get into that a little bit later. But, yeah, I just didn't – that was a little lazy.
I'm picking this up with – just with the West Wing. I haven't seen the other shows you're talking about. But this so this whole, like, this whole perspective of psychoanalysis and his characters seem to come through a lot now that you mention that. And, you know, Freud's
– What do you mean?
So – like a lot of the things that we talk about when we're talking about now and in previous episodes are how the character's psychology personally affect how they behave
and push
the plot forward.
Yeah.
Right? In post hoc ergo propter hoc.
Right.
In a proportional response.
Well, that's the good side of Sorkin. That's what makes his characters so deep, that they're not just doing it for, you know, for no reason.
Right. So I think that Freud's psychoanalysis perspective, which is he's really the forerunner in that, it would be incomplete to not throw in that little slip of his sister.
Yeah, I feel like it's I don't see people do that in real life.
Oh, I mean, I do though.
Really?
I don't ever see
I never do that. I never see people do that. Where
I do it.
Something so big like that? Really?
Yeah, because even afterwards he was like, yeah, but you know, we were just talking about her, so that's why I threw it in there.
I don't know.
I just do see that.
To me, it just seems so lazy, so cheap, and so easy. I don't know. I feel like there's better ways to do it.
Right. But I think one of my... Well, I think sometimes this happens. I think we're talking about this a lot now. But I think that like... I fundamentally do not believe that everything happens for a reason, and I can't stand when people say that.
I agree.
So
I can't stand it.
And I can't stand it. So if you're talking to me and you say it, just know in my head I'm rolling my eyes. But
you are so angry about it that in your head you're rolling your eyes. Don't let it ever be said that he's not polite on the outside. Oh, that's interesting. That's an interesting thing you said.
My God, this idiot. I think that when something slips like that, I don't think that it happened for a reason per se, but I think that...
So far as fate is concerned, it happened for a reason because there's a cause behind it.
Right, and I think that... And I don't believe in luck too, right? So I think those play nicely into each other, but when something happens...
I totally get that. I'm saying that I don't see that happen in reality.
Hmm.
That's the only thing I'm saying.
Hmm. I mean, I've seen it, so, you know, I can empathize.
All right. But yeah, so then you have... from this, that's when you have Josh tell CJ about the card.
Right.
And that's when we get to that part with the Ave Maria, the song, and then, you know, last episode we talked about, can you be great? Can you have, not good, by the way, and I don't think I mentioned this, we're not talking about being good at something, having a lasting, large impact, a Da Vinci-type impact, a Salinger, Shakespeare, all these names that will live on forever. Can you be that type of person and not be a complete asshole? And you know, you and I both said no. You ultimately are going to be seen that way by some people. This episode asks the question, do you have to be crazy in order to create something powerful?
Right, and I don't know, that's not my answer, but savants, you know, talk about a savant, usually that's connotated with negativity, some type of emotional, you know, problem, or some type of like neurosis if you're a savant.
Right.
But usually savant, you know what a savant is?
Yeah.
Usually savants are seen as geniuses.
Right.
But, you know, the double-edged sword for that is that, you know, they're also crazy. So, I don't know. I don't think that you need to be crazy in order to create something beautiful or powerful. I think that's... I don't know who said that in the episode.
Josh.
It was Josh. I think it was Josh.
It was either Josh or CJ. I'm almost positive it was Josh.
So yeah, I don't know if I believe that.
I think I do.
But yeah,
there was a book that came out a few years ago that talked about presidents, and it's been I read it when it first came out. Excuse me, and I haven't read it in a while. But it was about the book is called The First Rate Madness. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, we're giving it free marketing right now.
Yeah, I know, but okay. The book is called The First Rate Madness, and it talks about how the presidents in the United States who have had mental illness have had the biggest impact. And I think I'm going to grossly, water this down and simplify this. But generally speaking, it's when you have such hardship and you have to think outside the box as often as they do, that allows them to create where others fail. And I do believe there's something to that. I mean, it's so funny how like last episode and this episode emerging, we talked about Edison.
Right.
And I said how Edison stole everything from Tesla, which he did. Tesla was nuts. And Tesla created everything. Tesla was the man.
Well, how long ago was this? When this book that you're talking about was written in
First Rate Madness? I think it's like 5 years ago, maybe.
Oh, okay. Well, and the presidents that it talks about.
FDR, JFK, Lincoln. Who else? I don't remember. It's been a while since I read it.
Because, I mean, so the way that in society that we diagnose certain mental illnesses is set forth in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual.
Right.
And I know that changes. So I wonder now if those presidents would still be considered mentally ill based on what we know from the science of clinical psychology. Now, I'm not a clinical psychologist, so I can't speak about the viability of these mental illnesses. But it would be interesting to see if they really were mentally ill, or is this just like a...
I think they pretty much were. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, but
you're on the camp of like, no, you think that power can come from quite sane people.
Yeah, I think power. Well, say that again.
That you're disagreeing with Josh's assertion that you have to be crazy in order to create something powerful.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more on the side of our last conversation, last episode, where we said that sometimes to create something powerful, you need to be.
That's not what the last conversation was, though. The last conversation was in order to become a legend and make a lasting impact,
mm-hmm.
you have to be a little selfish,
right.
Very selfish, to the point where others will consider you to be less than savory. And this one is, in order to create something, it can be one thing and you're not even necessarily a legend, but you have to be crazy in order to do that.
Look at like Mark Zuckerberg. Like, he gets so much bash in the media from that movie The Social Network, which was an Aaron Sorkin piece.
Yeah.
And people see him as an asshole, right? But look what he created.
How do we know he's not mentally ill?
That's what I'm saying. We don't. So I'm questioning the viability of what we're labeling as mentally ill. So as much as I'm backing up what we said last time.
All right. Well, then if that's the case, then I'm not sure we can have a conversation about this, because then it's always going to be, well, I don't know what mentally ill is.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So I'm on the side of, I do think that that's probably true. Anthony's on the side of,
I think we need to figure. Yeah, we need to figure out. We need to figure out what exactly mental illness that they are all diagnosed with, and I'd be curious to study more about it. I'm just a little skeptical about that claim.
All right. So I have to bring up. So, do you remember when I was like, "There's a character in the pilot that's not going to be liked and it's going to get kicked off and this and that."
Wait, before you go on, I still want to talk about this Ave Maria theme of this whole hymn of protection.
Okay.
Because I don't think we covered all of this basically.
Okay.
Or do you want to come back?
Go ahead.
So I think that it also plays out, this whole theme of protection is, well, one, we said Josh trying to protect his staff and friends, right? Which is symbolic of the song being played in the background.
Right.
I think it also plays out with,
I think he's equally trying to protect himself.
Who, Josh?
Yes.
Interesting. Well, he's trying to protect himself from his own demons.
Yes.
Right. Okay, so that's that. That's
he can't,
interesting.
He can't live with himself.
Right. Right, yeah.
If he were to keep the card.
Right, that's
because he doesn't even technically have to use it. Hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's true.
He has to give it back.
Yeah. But it's like holding like a loaded gun, you know?
What do you mean?
Like, it's like you're giving this person a very powerful tool.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you do that with anyone that's in the West Wing of the White House.
But then why didn't Sam get one? I'm just upset Sam didn't get one.
I know you. I know. I'm upset Toby didn't get one. No, well, but you, CJ gave the reason. They don't need speechwriters when the end is nigh.
Yeah, yeah, it's a sad truth.
They don't need... There are so many sad truths in life. One of them is Sam Seaborn is not needed when there's a nuclear attack.
So wait, so there's that. I also think that the whole theme of protection is played out with the whole notion of the kid in the classroom with his hand up that doesn't get called on.
Toby,
right? I think because typically, from my experience in academia, is when you...
Or even academia.
Academia.
It's a macadamia. All right, go ahead.
The teachers are hesitant to call on the students that always have their hands up because they're typically the ones that know the answer.
Well, I mean, we haven't gotten into the Toby president thing yet, but I to stick a pin in that because, okay, you know, you brought it up. I feel like Toby is the president's conscience or guiding post or the person that is leading him or pushing him in the direction that he should go in, which plays into your whole, you know, doesn't want to call on him for that. So
right. There you go. I'm on Toby, board with that. That's Toby in my eyes. Again, this whole Ave Maria theme of Toby trying to protect the president from himself.
Right.
So there's that.
Okay.
There was another one, but I can't think of it right now. Protection.
I don't know if this is your
I'm
thing.
Looking at Joe
Not
for
me.
Help.
They had the meeting at the end. There was chili, smallpox. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, if it comes back, I'll just blurt it out.
Okay. Well, we just I'll blurt it out. Yeah. We just touched on... We just touched on Toby and the president, and from the opening scene with that ridiculous basketball game with... Did you know who the basketball player was, by the way?
How cool would it be to play basketball with the president?
I think it would be very
that
cool.
That would be so cool. Like smack-talking him and
it would
stuff?
It would be better to play with a president who knows how to play. I think Obama knows how to play. I think I've seen him play. Not personally, but on TV. It's a whole other thing when you're watching these guys that can't dribble. They had to do cuts so that it didn't look like Toby was god awful.
That was pretty bad. Just
it was
watching Toby
the
dribble.
The cut was so bad. It was like, oh, he's losing the ball. He only dribbled twice. I was losing the ball already. But did you know who the basketball player
was? Who was it?
Juwan Howard.
Oh.
Fab Five?
Yeah.
Were you like 10 when Fab Five
probably,
was out?
Yeah.
No, you were probably like 4, actually. What year was that? 1990, 1992?
When? The Fab
Five? I think
Five?
The Fab Five
were
like 92.
Yeah, then I was 3.
Whoa!
I'm just aging myself now.
Whoa! Yeah, I know. That's true. Well, that was Juwan Howard from the Fab Five. But from that scene, Toby says, the better angels of President Bartlett are being shouted down by his, you know, desire to win. And... again, paralleling from the last episode, I think this is an interesting discussion because, you know, from the last episode, we were talking about how Leo couldn't see the forest for the trees and his desire was to win. And now you're looking at the president. And Toby's main 2 points are, the first one is, there's flaws in the gun bill. We should raise those flaws. And then the second one was, he didn't want to be hypocritical insofar as cashing Hollywood's check on Tuesday and admonishing them on Wednesday and being kind of above reproach regarding that. And they got into some semantics about, you know, gratuitous sex and gratuitous violence and not being able to stop people from wanting to watch crap, which is absolutely true. And that's a really genuine argument. And then it devolves into this Joe McCarthy thing. And I thought that was signaling how... this is like a deep thing that kind of spun out of control, because it really did. And I think it really starts with that whole idea that Toby just wants to challenge the president to be the great man he thinks he is.
Mm.
And the president, I don't know, just isn't doing it, and for whatever reason, and is focused on winning. And so then the question is raised, what is more important, governing or staying strong? Because as Leo said in the last episode, you can't govern if you aren't strong. But if you're always strong and concerned with that, you're not governing.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to that. That's what makes politics so hard. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But say more about it, because you're on a roll.
No, no, no. I'm asking you, like, what is more important?
Governing or getting power?
Yeah.
I'm always an advocate of the process. I like breaking down processes, going through things. And I think that with effective governing, power will come. If that makes sense. So I don't think focusing on power as the outcome should be anybody's MO. I think it should.
Even if the thing that you want to do is political suicide.
I mean,
so you're all about the president being honest about how the gun bill fails, even if it's going to anger your own party and kind of give juice to the other party.
I mean, there's gray in it, right? There's gray. It's not. I don't think it's about being black and white here, you know. And I think that's what you're trying to make a distinction between. I think.
Well, no. What I'm saying is that Toby's on one side and the president's on another. Now, I agree that there's gray in the middle, because I don't think you can have one or the other, but I'm just wondering if one is more important.
I mean, personally, I've always erred on the side of process, governing.
Right.
I think that that's more important. But in such a political situation...
Yeah.
It's got to be a balancing act. I don't think that one is more important than the other. I don't think one precedes the other. I think that it's, I don't know. I think that it's simultaneous and it's a balancing act. But well, I think you should stay true to, you know, your party's beliefs, because they're the ones that
matter. Or your own beliefs. Or your really. Own,
right. By your party, yeah. I mean,
and I think that's why it's so important that you have someone like Toby who is kind of like your guidepost. Because you need that.
We all need that. We all always. Need that.
But you could see how the president, I mean.
And who's, we talked about this remotely, I think in like this episode 2, all the way back then, when you said, when we were talking about naivete, how do you say that word?
Naivete.
Yeah. And having, it was, this is the conversation, it was between Sam and CJ, when, I think it was in a proportional response.
Oh, about what it looks like versus right. What it is.
And it's kind of like when you're naive, you need that person to come down hard on you to open your eyes.
Right.
And I think that's kind of what we're talking about here right now. Like, the president has these ideas, but he needs Toby to bring him back to reality sometimes.
Yeah.
And even at the end, the president says, you know, you are pretty much most of the time, you're right.
Yeah.
And I need you, and I would be nowhere if it wasn't for you.
And I think you learned a lot about their relationship and who Toby was. Because Toby's been really in the background for the most part. And this is the first time they got to see. I loved the part where the president said, I know you're disappointed. And then he corrects himself and says, I can sense your disappointment. And that's really important, because everyone has respect for the president. No one more than Toby. For the president to say, I know you're disappointed, and then to correct himself and say, I mean, I sense your disappointment, means that he would never be disappointed in front of him. He would never allow that to be demonstrated. It would never allow that to be shown.
Say that again. So Toby's disappointment.
Toby has too much respect for the president to be demonstrative in his disappointment. The only way the president can know that is that he senses it from him. So it's not about being frustrated with this guy. It's about, I see this greatness in you, and I need you to be the person that I that I that we all want you to be. And he never backs off it. I think from that one line, you know that it's not about Toby's own ego, about being right. It's about getting this president to be who he can be. To self-actualize. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that Toby sees the president as a mentor in some capacity?
No.
No?
No, not at all.
Hmm.
I think Toby is so beyond mentor and stuff like that. No.
Hmm.
I do believe that he looks at the president as the embodiment of faith he has in government and what it can be.
Huh.
And that's why he strives so hard.
Right. I'm trying to think of a good question, like a parallel. Like, have you ever had somebody that you saw had tremendous potential and you just wanted them to self-actualize?
Yeah. This is like deep stuff, because this person I can't actually name, but yes, and it's heartbreaking to see them not be able to do it.
Do you think that they've passed the point of?
I don't think you ever pass the point, but certainly opportunity on how to do it diminishes as you get older.
Oh, so you think it's an age thing, a time thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Because say like, you know, the thing that that person could do is become a doctor. Well, it's hard to go to medical school at the age of 50.
That argument I always challenge the impact of time versus experience, because I feel like you could experience a lot of things in such a short amount of time.
Again, it just depends on what it is. Again, if it's a doctor, you have to go to medical school. You have to go for X number of years.
Yeah.
Musician, if you had the ability to be a musician. I mean, look at acting. You know, for a lot of women, if you're not 18, 19, 20, 21, chances are that ship has sailed.
Acting.
And that's terrible.
You know, and I dated a dancer.
And it's not
the same thing, yeah.
It's not to say that it's impossible, but it certainly gets harder.
Yeah.
Now, like to be a chef or, you know, start your own business, no, you can do that when you're 70. But for certain
I think what you're picking up on is that anything worth anybody's time is going to take you time to develop. And like, because even if you wanted to be a chef, you can go to school whenever you want, because you're still going to have to go to school essentially for it. You're going to have to learn things. You can't just pick up.
Again, that's that experience thing. And experience, you can have all the experience in the world. You just don't have the guts to put it all on the line.
Hmm. Yeah, well, yeah.
It's circumstantial. I mean, now we're getting bogged down in nuance, but it's circumstantial. It depends on what's going on.
Interesting. I mean, I have personally friends in my life that I see who I've been friends with for a very long time, who I've always thought that, wow, if you guys could just see what you have, like, I wish you can see yourself through my eyes.
And what do you do?
I mean, there's only so much you can do. Right? Like, you could talk to them, you could push them, but essentially, you know, you could lead a horse to water, but you can't make a drink.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm always caught in that situation with people who I feel like have so much potential, but I just can't get them to take the next step.
Okay. Now imagine that that person embodies everything that you're working towards, because that's what it is for Toby. Toby sees all these great things in the president and what he could be. The world can move or not, I think he says, based on a couple of words. I probably brutalize that, but it's true. There's this guy in front of him. No, he doesn't idolize him. No, he doesn't do any of those things. But he sees in him the embodiment of everything he believes in. And he's desperate to make that guy live up to those ideals.
Hmm.
It's such a great relationship. I love that relationship. And I love that this is the first time that we get to see it.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing with David Rosen, which, by the way, okay, so this is what I was going to bring back before. And we can bounce around. It's totally fine. But this is what I was going to say before. Remember how in the first episode I was saying something like, you know, there's a character that people end up hating and gets written off.
Right.
Do you know who that is? Have you figured it out yet?
I mean, I still don't like a couple of characters.
Who do you not like?
Well, from last episode, I still don't like the vice president.
Okay, it's not the vice president.
All right, well, who is it then?
Because he wasn't in the first episode.
Right.
It's Mandy.
Mandy. The bad driver.
The bad driver. Ah, the bad driver. Yes, the bad driver.
Got it.
Mandy. Now, people hate her. Like, hate her.
Like, why?
I don't know. Moira Kelly, she was in The Cutting Edge with D.B. Sweeney. Was it D.B. Sweeney?
I don't know.
I think it was D.B. Sweeney. She was the voice of Simba's girlfriend in The Lion King. It's Moira Kelly. Like, what's the problem? Problem is, her character sucks. Character sucks. And I think it's true, though. And I think that the problem is that the president's on the show. I think she suffers by the fact that the president's on the show. Think about it. She's the media relations director.
Right.
How interesting is that when you have a media, a person who's in charge of how someone is perceived when you never actually see them? That's fascinating. I can't imagine how Sorkin would have written that character. But when the president's on the show, now she's just like a fifth wheel or third wheel or whatever odd number wheel that you don't need. That's what she is.
Hey, you know what's also in my head right now? Whatever happened to her assistant or her employee or that other woman?
Oh, yeah, that chick. Well, yeah, but like, they don't have enough room.
Oh, well, that's a shame.
Yeah, I feel bad.
That's sad.
Yeah, well, like, you should feel bad for the actress, not the character.
Yeah, I do. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, good.
The poor lady.
Because that character theoretically lives on in that world. But no, but then you have... Now you have, and this is why, and it's so easily corrected. It's so easily corrected. Now what you have is a character who's there only to push the plot along, seemingly for no reason. She goes into Toby's office, is like, I'm going to be nice to you. I'm glad David Rosen didn't take your job. And now it pushes Toby further in the plot. And it just comes out of left field. It's not good writing. I hate that part. And that becomes the embodiment of her character. All she does is pop her head up every now and again, push the plot along for seemingly no reason. Remember when we talked about last episode how one thing moved the next thing forward,
right, forward? Right. It's like a domino.
Exactly. That's not what happens in this episode. You could have had it. You could have had Toby sit there and Mandy come in and be like, listen, you know, I'm sorry about you losing on this thing, but you need to, you know, keep your chin up. The president still respects you. Right. And he would have been like, honestly, there are days that I feel like I don't know why he even picked me for this job, you know? And she could be like, well, you know, he didn't really want you, but and like, what do you mean? Oh, nothing. Or, you know what I mean? There are other ways to do it instead of her just being like, I'm glad David Rosen didn't get your job. End scene.
Well,
it's so cheap.
Well, Joe, she answers to me,
and she answers to Toby.
That's really what she's doing, and I feel like it's great that she's only answering to Toby and Josh.
Touche, sir. Touche. That was good. That was good. But it bothers me. I feel like it's just such a cheap way, and this is what happens to this character. And this is why people hate her. And I don't like her, but I will defend her because I feel like she gets a raw deal.
Yeah.
Do you even get a sense of who she is?
I mean, I don't pay attention to her, as bad as that sounds. I don't know.
That's because there's nothing to pay attention to.
Oh, that's sad.
Well, but it's true.
I know it is, but it's like, aw.
Which, by the way, I mean, I think now we got to talk about, because it makes me think of it. We talk about how like Sorkin can be sexist sometimes.
Right.
I feel like
Wait.
What? Protection theme.
Protection theme.
All right.
The chili. That was,
wait, can you do the do whoa 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 again?
Do whoa whoa whoa.
That was good. All right.
It's never good the second time.
It's never good the second time.
That's a metaphor for life,
that's
people.
That's from a man that knows what he's talking about, ladies. And I'm just talking to ladies right now. All right, go ahead.
Thanks, Joe. No. The chili.
Okay, the
chili. It's a comfort food, right?
Yeah.
So that's the whole theme of protection. the whole Ave Maria thing, going back to that.
Okay.
The president is trying to protect his staff by making everyone
comfort
food.
I wonder if
food.
That's stretching a little bit. Well, I'll tell you this. I'll say this. I will agree with you insofar as I don't know if it's about protection for me so much as it is about complacency. A lot of this episode is about complacency versus challenges and going beyond. Toby is in this episode is forever pushing people to go forward. Josh is talking about how this card is a flag, a white flag of surrender. about being complacent, about not getting better, not moving forward. We only have 7, vaccinations of smallpox. We need to do more. We need to do better. Even the president in his speech at the end, when he talks about these are the things of the past, that satellite is a relic of the past. Complacency, the past, things that are easy. What's gonna push us forward? What's gonna make us do better?
You know, that's
so for me, that kind of ties into the whole idea of comfort versus uncomfortability in terms of challenging.
That's interesting. You know, and I think this plays out a lot in politics. I think, you know, just to sum up everything you just said, I think it's being content with the status quo.
Yes, yes.
I think that,
and politics is very much about that.
And I think that that's the struggle you're talking about.
And that's what Toby's going through.
Right. I mean, and even in terms of like organizations and businesses, right? When you're content with the status quo, you don't innovate, you don't grow, you don't push the organization forward.
That's even in personal life too. I mean, when you're complacent, that's a dangerous place to be.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
right.
You should always be striving and continuing.
Right. Wait, what's the quote? Idle hands are devil's playground.
Well, that's a little religious for me. But.
Right. Well, I mean, like, you should never be satisfied.
Right.
With, and that's just a personal belief of myself. I feel like to push ourselves forward as people, we should never be satisfied with where we are. We should always be trying to push ourselves.
Exactly.
Out of our comfort zone.
And I think
that
was the ultimate message of this episode. I mean, again, I didn't love the construction of it. It, you know, you get all the things that play into one another. Smallpox being the thing that could be the next world war, and how it happens to be something that was a great achievement. How there is no red phone anymore, and there's no Russia's not going to bomb us.
Right.
And then the president talks about how that satellite is from that era. There's a lot of that, but still, you know, I think the ultimate theme of this episode is about challenging oneself and moving forward, especially on the heels of the last episode, where basically a victory is not really all that much about a victory.
That's interesting.
And I think that kind of, it almost, you know, you can even, like, we can even talk about now, like, where is this presidency? Are they doing anything?
They're making chili.
They're making chili. And I guess not that well, because Zoe Bartlett, who, by the way, Elizabeth Moss, first episode that she appears in, one of my favorite actresses in Mad Men, is the best part of Mad Men.
Hmm.
She's hands down. She's not that good in this episode, and I think in the beginning in The West Wing, she's not that good. She may have been starting out, but she's a phenomenal actress.
Hmm.
But yeah, I don't want to forget about just the whole crackpot and women thing.
Right, let's talk about the sexist thing now. Because I'm sorry I cut you off with
the
chili.
No, it's fine. It just drives me nuts. I mean, like, the way, look at these women. We can't get over these women. This one is so capable, like a 50s movie star. And Mandy's told to sit down and shut up, but she wants Toby. Is that what women want? That they want to be revered and put on a pedestal and spoken about as if they were these other things? I could see how women, and I don't think Sorkin means it like that, but just because you don't mean it like that doesn't mean that that's not how it comes across. And I'm totally okay with women being upset by that. Am I reading into that? Do you get that? Or
no, I get that. Yeah.
Don't put them on a pedestal. Don't revere them. That's right. Like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah. I feel like we should also talk, not right now, but in one of these episodes, we should talk about just women in general and how...
I'm all about talking about women. What do you want to talk about?
I don't know if we want to talk about it right now.
Okay.
We'll be here for hours.
All right.
But, you know, but maybe by... I don't know. Well, I don't know.
In terms of what, though?
Just like the whole, like, to combat the whole sexism thing. Because I feel like I consider myself a feminist, right? And feminism is just when somebody believes, correct me if I'm wrong, when someone believes that
I don't know.
Men
I
and women just have equal
I
rights.
I try to not have, I don't know what the labels are. I don't eat any animal products. I believe in animal rights. I believe right. that you shouldn't, all that stuff with animals. But I don't know that I would consider myself a vegan. I don't know what that word means.
Okay.
I don't know. Labels are very tricky.
Right. Well, we assign labels to things to make it convenient for us.
Absolutely.
Right.
But like you're asking me what a feminist is. I don't know. I have my own belief systems. You right. know what I mean?
All right. Well, in Webster's Dictionary, I think it's defined as someone who believes that men and women should have equal rights.
Okay.
And I think that me and you both are coming from that perspective, sure. which is why we're seeing things in certain episodes. And why Sorkin gets all of this bash about being sexist, because a lot of the undertone in his writing is that, no, there is a difference in the way that they're treated.
Well, I would just suggest looking at it from the alternative point of view. I mean, would you ever imagine a scene being written where these women were like, we can't get over these men. These men... That guy, he lives in a world where a man is supposed to be a man, yet he can still appreciate a flower and wants to raise kids.
And you know what?
You know what I mean? Like, it just, there's no, and the fact that you have to do that right. in the way that he does it with women is at the same time patronizing as it is stilted. And it feels just uneven and it's uncomfortable yeah. and I would never talk about a woman like that. And I don't know that any woman wants to be talked about.
No,
like
right.
that.
Exactly. And I would go so far to say is if there ever was a scene that was written in the antithesis of right. with the, when the woman's talking, like they'd probably get bashed out for that too.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And it's in the title and right. it's a great title, Crackpots and These Women and all that stuff. But I just... To me, it just speaks of a different mindset of a different time. It seems like an older form of feminism when in order to align yourself with women and their cause, you had to speak about them in an exaggerated way.
Hmm.
You don't need to... These
I wonder if
women don't need to be spoken about. You know, like, I don't need to applaud my mother for being a mother.
Right. What I'm thinking now is maybe... This older interpretation of feminism, like you're picking up on, do you think that that was considered chivalrous? Like when Sorkin was writing this?
I don't know. This is the late 90s. This is 1999.
Right. I mean, we're talking almost 20 years now.
I feel like you see in the older characters Sorkin's mindset on these things, where it's I go out of my way to explain how we're equal.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it seems like you're not equal. I think that's what that is. And I think it's just an older mindset. And it's ever evolving. That's why I have a very difficult time with like what's feminism, what's veganism, what's
right.
social. Well, socialism is a little bit different.
All these isms.
Yeah, it's just like I don't really, you know. And that's why I was comfortable doing this podcast, because I don't think of myself as a Democrat or a Republican.
Right.
You know, I think there are good ideas from both. And I don't have a problem with saying that. And I don't have to worry about like being political and all this other stuff. And I feel like you might be the same way and you're open-minded. You know, when you get into that stuff, it's just too difficult. But you can call a spade a spade. You can say, hey, this is a thing. By the way, speaking of isms, spade a spade is not a racial remark. I learned that recently.
Hmm.
You know what is? Peanut gallery.
Really?
Peanut gallery is racist.
What, from what?
So apparently, I guess it's two ways, right? So first of all, when you went to like the theater or the movies or whatever, black people weren't allowed to sit with white people, so they had to sit upstairs, okay? Mm. And... You know, if they were making noise, we don't want to hear anything from the peanut gallery.
Huh.
So it was referring to them. And then peanuts were a cheap food that you could eat at the theater.
Hmm.
And George Washington Carver and his relationship with peanuts, et cetera, et cetera. The two things merged. Peanut gallery is racist. Did you?
Wow. That's amazing. That's, I learned something today.
There you go. And I always thought that calling a spade was racist. But then I recently found out it's actually not.
Huh.
So I get to use that now.
Any more fun facts?
I've got many, but I'm going to go with SCUBA, stands for Secured Wait, what is it? Underwater breathing apparatus? Self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. Nailed it. All right, what else? I don't know. What do you have?
I think that I just really want to play basketball with Obama.
I was going to say, the thing I was going to say, we just have to make sure that we play it with people that can play. Can't bring, right. As much as I love Toby, can't bring Toby.
Can't bring a Toby.
Can't bring a Toby. Bring a Toby.
Can't bring
a Toby. I might be a Toby. Yeah. I want to talk about Pluie some more. No, all right.
Pluie? What about Baloo the Bear?
I love, it's Bonnie. All right. Baloo.
Hey, The Jungle Book was probably one of my most favorite movies as a kid.
That trailer looks really good.
It did. I did see that. Oh, boy.
I'm all about that.
And Kipling. Oh, my God. Talk about good authors.
Rudyard Kipling, you mean? I thought that was like a movie.
I love him.
Wait, Rudyard?
What is his name?
Is that Rudyard?
I don't know. I call him Rudyard.
Yeah, why?
No, no, no.
Who the hell are you talking about?
Kipling.
I know Kipling, but that'd be like
he wrote one of my most favorite poems in the entire world. Okay. The poem is called If.
All right.
And for those of you who don't know the poem, which is probably everyone listening, go look up the poem If by Rudyard Kipling.
Rudyard Kipling. And I will counter that, sir. One of my favorite poems is called Despondency by Matthew Arnold. Look up that one.
Hmm.
Yeah.
How's that tie into the Jungle Book?
It doesn't, but you said you liked one, and I was going to give them, you know, I was going to give them two.
No, since we're talking about poems.
Now we're done. That's
wait,
it.
Wait. No, don't pivot yet. John Donne, A Valediction Forbidding Morning.
Okay, very good.
All right, thanks for letting me get that in.
Okay. All right, that's it. That's episode 5 with a little poetry action there, crackpots and these women. We'll be back with episode 6 very shortly. Thank you so much, guys, for listening. We had a lot of fun with this one. This one was a little deeper.
I thought the last one was deep. But for some reason, we pulled this one.
This one was a little
bit
serious.
This was serious.
You know, there was a lot more, that whole Josh thing, it was a serious thing.
Because, yeah, it's personal. It from his past.
And it's old, too.
Ave Maria is just a haunting song.
It is. And Pluie is the most
all right,
awesome
you and Pluie.
I love the animals. I do. The animals are my friends. The animals are my friends.
Okay.
Animals are friends, not food. What is that? That's from Finding Nemo, right?
Oh,
it's fish are friends, not food.
Yeah.
But then what do they eat? Sharks.
Fish food.
Have you not seen Nemo?
No.
We're leaving. All right, we're going to go watch Nemo now. All right, guys. Thank you very much. We'll be back with another episode. This is Joseph Amato saying goodbye and thank you.
And this is Anthony. I can't say AC out, but AC out.
Oh, man.